5. So if you'll just insert that in the back of your notebooks, you'll be good to go when we get to that part of our study. Page 17 and Galatians chapter 4. It's been a week since we studied, and that was not by our design, of course. Glad everyone's all right from the events of this past week. So we'll talk about this morning what was planned to be discussed on Wednesday night. And that's in the fourth chapter of Galatians. We're in the midst of this section that we're calling the second Galatian chastisement, which is verses 8 through 20. And just to refresh our memories, if you look back in your folders on pages 15 and 16. The first box on page 15, you'll see where we have the fourth chapter divided up. With these two examples, the fourth chapter begins with Paul talking about two ways he wants to illustrate these promises that he's been talking about in the third chapter made to Abraham. And the first seven verses is the first illustration, the illustration of the average or ordinary home with a male heir who's a minor child and a slave, and how they are alike in one respect but different in another respect. And we covered that. And then the second illustration is we're getting ready to get to it, which starts at verse 21. Thank you. Starts at verse 21. You need one. Goes through the end of the chapter, which is the allegory of Sarah and Hagar. So we're inching up on getting to discuss that one. And in between those two examples, that's the box that's on page 16 now. Is Paul sort of, seems to me, just sort of pauses in that discussion to address one more time specifically and to the point the Galatians. He sort of chastises them. He rebukes them again, sort of fusses at them on some points. And that's what we're in the middle of, is these verses, verses 8 through 20. And he just goes back and he mentions some things that would be hopefully in their minds as well, in their memory, because when he was with them, they certainly were laboring with Paul. Paul taught them. He traveled through the region, shared with them the gospel, and spent some time in Galatia. So he sort of harkens back and mentions those specific events. He also reminds them, as an example, he says in verse 13, it was because of a bodily illness or a physical infirmity that I preached the gospel to you. So in some way, Paul suffered physically while he was going through Galatia. And he says at the last part of verse 12, he said, "Now you've done me no wrong. You didn't treat me wrong. You received me well." In fact, in verse, let me find it here, the last part of verse 14, not only did they receive him well, but Paul says, "You saw me how? As an angel. That's how well you received me, even in my pitiful, ailing condition," again, whatever that was. And so we talked about, and we didn't try to speculate too much, but this has always been questioned when people studied the book of Galatians. Well, what was this ailment that Paul talked about? Well, the Bible's not, doesn't tell us what it is. It's silent about that. But the guess that speculated the most is it has something to do with Paul's eyes because of his comments in verse 15 of this chapter, as well as how he starts to conclude the book with, "See with what large letters I write to you with my own hand." If it wasn't his eyes, it's no big deal. We can't say for certain, but he does make mention of that. So he says, you didn't despise me. You received me well. And now he says, the first part of verse 15, where then has that sense of blessing? I mean, you received me so well back then. Now that he's not there in Galatia, and as we've been continuing to emphasize throughout these studies, who is in Galatia now? Paul's not there, but who is there? Well, I meant in a bad way. The Judaizers are there, and they're undermining Paul, and they're discrediting Paul, trying to knock him down a few notches, so that the Christians, especially the Gentile Galatians, those who are of a Gentile heritage, would succumb to their teaching and embrace their version of the law. And that's what Paul's having to fight in this entire epistle. So he says, I know how you felt about me then, but I just like to know, where has that sense of blessing gone? Well, you treated me so well at the first, you're not doing that now. So he says in verse 16, therefore, I'm trying to tell you and teach you the truth. Have I therefore become your enemy? I know I was your friend before. I know you loved me. I loved you. I know how you received me and treated me then. But now am I your enemy? Because I'm telling you what you need to hear. And basically is, you need to get away from these Judaizing teachers. They're false teachers. They're leading you farther away from the Lord rather than bringing you closer to Him. And this is where we got to last Sunday morning, verses 16 and 17. And let's just go back and read those verses again. He says in verse 16, have I therefore become your enemy by telling you the truth? They, that would be the Judaizers, they eagerly seek you, not commendably, my version says, but they wish to shut you out in order that you may seek them. So what did the Judaizers want? Well, they didn't want a relationship to exist between who? The Galatians and Paul. They wanted to estrange them from Paul. The last part of verse 17, why? So that they would seek who? Them. They wanted to be the ones that the Galatians would come to and what they taught. And so if they could discredit Paul, if they could cause this tension, if they could cause this strained relationship between the Galatian Christians and Paul, they would have accomplished their purpose. They would have achieved their goal, if you will. And that's what they're wanting through all this. So this is where we pick up this morning in our classes. The Judaizers sought the Galatians. In fact, Paul admits it up front. But they didn't seek them for honorable purposes. Had Paul sought the Galatians out? Absolutely. When he went through Galatia, and not just one time, but we can go back and look at those instances in the journeys in Acts. Paul sought them out on many occasions. And were his purposes honorable? Absolutely. Trying to teach them the gospel. So the Judaizers are seeking them out, but he says not commendably. They sought them to shut them off from the Apostle Paul, and the desire was that the Galatians would only seek them and not Paul. Again, as I say, if they could achieve that, then they got what they wanted. And no longer would there be this kinship, if you will, or this relationship between the Galatians and Paul. And that's what they're trying to prevent, if you will. So, verse 18, Paul praises the Galatians. He says, it is good always to be eagerly sought in a commendable manner. Paul praised the Galatians for how they sought him. They sought him commendably. But how does he sort of put that in his context, the last part of verse 18? What's he remind them of? Well, I know you sought me well, but under what condition? When I was there. How should they be seeking him now, even though he's not there? Same way. That's the problem. I'm not there to defend myself. I'm not there, and these guys are knocking me down every chance they get. And you're listening to them. You're not listening to me. But who really had the relationship? Well, Paul and the Galatians had the relationship, based on him coming through and teaching them. So he says, it is good always to be eagerly sought in a commendable manner, and not only when I'm present with you. So what if you only like someone, or you're only going to treat somebody well when you're with them physically? Then what do you really have? Well, that's hypocrisy. You don't really have a relationship. Not at all. But true relationships will be what they ought to be, whether the parties are physically together or they're separated. And that's what Paul is emphasizing on this occasion. That only shouldn't exist as if he was with them. In fact, even more so now, Paul having to write this letter, it's the same Paul writing the letter as if it were the Paul that was with him when he went through Galatia. And they should have known that. So let's just pretend for a moment to put ourselves in the minds of these Galatians. Here we are. Let's say we're the Galatians, all right. We're here in Galatia, and in come these Judaizing teachers, and we start hearing the things they say about Paul and against Paul. What should we have said in response? That's right. Now, wait just a minute. We know this man you're talking about. He came through and He taught us the gospel. In fact, in verse 19, how does Paul refer to them? My children. So in a sense, they could have said, He's our Father. In a figure of speech, not literally, of course. He's our Father. He brought us the gospel. He tutored us. He guided us. He nurtured us. He taught us. And we're not about to let you sit here and talk about Him and to accuse Him and discredit Him the way that you're doing it, because, number one, He isn't here to defend Himself. See, what do you think about someone who talks about someone else when that person is not there to answer those charges? How do we normally treat that? That's right. We don't stand for that. Especially if it's someone that we're very fond of, someone that we love and that we appreciate. Well, that's what they should have done. But what are they doing with these Judaizers? Well, they're listening to them. And they're starting to accept some of their teachings. And that's what's got Paul so upset. That's what's got him so puzzled. The last part of verse 20, which we'll see just in a moment. What did Paul say again? He says, I'm puzzled. I'm perplexed. And hasn't he made such statements earlier? Well, back in chapter 1, what did he say in verse 6? I am amazed that you are so soon removed from the gospel. I'm really surprised. I'm shocked that you all are acting this way. Because I know you and you know me, and I know that you, this doesn't really describe who I really thought you were. So that's the general makeup of this chastisement. Look at verse 19, the first part of verse 19. This takes us, in your outline, this is on page 17. It's about question 20, if we're trying to follow our notes here. The King James says, my little children. That's a very tender term of affection. I'm not sure the word little is in the original text. That's why most other versions just say my children. John used my little children a lot in his writings, and this is the only occasion where Paul used it, if it's indeed correct. But at any rate, whether it's my little children or my children, Paul says, my children with whom I again am in labor until Christ be formed in you. He had already given birth to the Galatian saints. There's going to be some very expressive language here in these next two verses. Again, not literally. But as you read what Paul says, my little children, with whom, again, I am in labor. How does that express what Paul thought about these Christians? All right. That's good, Mike. That's a good way to put that. And especially those of you, our sisters, who have birthed children. I want you to think about this for a moment. When you were in labor with your children, some of it's not pleasant. A very painful experience. But when you get to hold that little baby, what do you think about that little child? Instant bond and affection. You can't think of a strong enough word for love to describe your feelings for that child. You brought this child into the world and you labored and you struggled and you endured great pain. Now you take that idea and plug in Paul here. How did he feel about the Galatians? Well, when he was going through Galatia, he struggled and he labored and he gave birth to these Christians. And he loved them. And so now as he's hearing about their falling away and they're heeding these false teachers, what's that doing to his heart? It's breaking it. He's just so anxious over this and just agonizing pain. Now he felt that he, as if he were in birth labor all over again. It's as if Paul is saying, I've already been through this process once. And now to have to write this letter, how did it feel to Paul? I'm doing it all over again. We've struggled about this already. We shouldn't have to be going through this thing again. But because you're heeding these teachers, it's causing me great turmoil inside. And I just wished it wasn't so. But we can truthfully say, Paul had not changed his feelings toward the Galatians. He still loved them. Enough that he wrote this letter by inspiration to try to rid them of these false teachers and save them their trouble. This phrase in the last part of verse 19, my children with whom I am again in labor until Christ be formed in you. That's an interesting statement. It continues what I'll call the birth language here of the verse. Some Greek grammarians, Robertson's one of them, he says this phrase is from an old Greek word that signifies the manner in which an embryo is formed or shaped inside the womb. Till Christ be formed in you. While a woman carries a child, is that child being formed? Well, yes, in many respects. And she'll eventually give birth to that child that can then, of course, live outside the womb. So Paul is saying, I labored over you until you be formed, until you be brought to a mature enough state that you could live outside this birthing process. I want you to get a sense of how Paul is using these very expressive, these tender statements. He's not just writing a cold letter and indifferently saying, in essence, you stupid people, why can't you see what's going on? No, he still addressed them very tenderly and talked with them in a way that was from his heart. But he's still being stern. It required at least some of that so that they would know just how dangerous they were in going away from the truth and the gospel that Paul taught them. So he says, I'm in labor all over again until Christ be formed in you. So what did Paul desire the most? Verse 20, this chastisement section comes to a close. He says, I could wish what? Well, what do you really want? Wish I could be there. Now, where he wrote these letters, he's not with them. He's forced to write the letter. He said, but if I had my druthers, I wish I was there. I could address you and address this situation in person. I could wish to be present with you now and to change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. Well, he wanted to be in Galatia. He was perplexed at their behavior. He would rather be there to address them face to face instead of writing a letter, and he would take a different tone in person. Now, the question is, would he be more stern in person, or would he be more tender in person? Well, I don't know if you can take it either way. But his point is, if I were there, I would address you somewhat differently than I have to in this letter. There are stern moments in this letter, but there's also tender moments too. And if Paul were in person, I'm sure he would look them right in the eye, as a father would his children, and really lay down the law. But at the same time, also show some tenderness, as a parent would, children who would know better than what they're doing. Okay, so that pretty much takes us through question 20 on page 17. This chastisement. Anybody have any comments or questions? Any other observations you'd like to? Yes. Yes, and in the second Corinthian letter, he makes mention of that first letter. He said, I was sorry to have to write it, but I really wasn't sorry because I needed to say these things to you. And he was rather stern with them, as he needed to be. Okay. Now, if we don't have anything else to discuss about this interruption, verses 8 through 20, the chastisement, let's get to the second illustration, which starts at verse 21 and goes to the end of the chapter. And this begins us with question 21. About verse 21. What is the rhetorical question Paul asks in Galatians 4 and verse 21? He says, tell me something. Tell me what? And who is he talking to? Or he says, tell me, you who want to be under law, do you not even hear the law? Well, who were the ones that wanted to be under law? Okay. Well, we have one of two choices. Either he's addressing the Judaizers or he's addressing the Galatians. Now, I'm going to pick the latter. I think it's the Galatians because I don't think you can find very many places in the letter, in fact, if any, where Paul even specifically addressed the Judaizers. He didn't write to them. He wrote to the Galatians. So here were some Galatians who were wanting to be taught by the Judaizers. So Paul says, you Galatians, you who want to be under the law, you who want to adopt this teaching of the Judaizers, do you not even hear the law? So already, what's Paul going to be referencing? Where's he going to be staking his argument on? The Old Testament. And he'll do this again in a very powerful way. If you've never read the allegory straight through, Galatians 4, 21 through 31, it's a very, very powerful argument that Paul makes. And in my thinking, it just about slams the door shut on the Judaizers' argument. I mean, it pretty much takes care of it. Puts it right where it needs to be. So I believe this to be a question addressed to Galatians, the Galatian Christians, who were siding with the Judaizers and who were wanting to be justified on a law basis. Well, Paul says, all right, let's just pretend. For sake of argument, let's say that you've got the right position here. I'm going to show you that you're not even listening to the law. You don't even have the foggiest idea of what the law to which you're making your claim to, what it even says about all this. And I'm going to show you just how wrong you are about it. So let's look at this allegory. Look at the next part of the first verse, verse 22. What's he say? For it is written. See, already he's bringing up, what does it actually say? What does it actually state? That's a powerful claim that Paul will now review what is found in the law to answer this question that he's asking of the Galatians. It's the story of Abraham's two sons, whose names were, in birth order, Ishmael and Isaac. And really the story is not about them as much as it's about their mothers, whose names were, in order, Hagar and Sarah. That's really where Paul's going to go with this. I asked you where it was found, the last part of question 22. This is recorded for us in Genesis chapters 16, 17, and 18, as well as chapter 21. So if you're familiar with that book, and most of us are, you can go back and you can reread those chapters, and you get a really good backdrop, if you will, a background for the points that Paul's going to bring out through all this. All right, page 18 now is where we go, verses 24 through 29. Let's look at the example. Right. One son was born of the bondwoman. Now, who was the bondwoman? Why was Hagar the bondwoman? She was Sarah's maid or Sarah's servant. So she was not free. Well, that then makes Sarah the free woman, obviously. So that's the points that Paul's going to be. And identifying the bondwoman is important in the allegory. And by the way, what's an allegory? I think last part of question 23. Define allegory. What's that mean? What's the word allegory mean? All right. It's a story, kind of like a parable. I looked it up, a symbolic story where the elements have a representative meaning. That's how Webster defines allegory. There's one, I'm not getting too picky about this, this is really outside our studies, but there's one way that an allegory differs from a parable. We studied parables in here one quarter. When you look at one of the Lord's parables, and you just can pick some at random, not every detail has a meaning in a parable. For example, Jesus told those three parables in Luke 15. The man that had the lost sheep, or the lost lamb, the woman who had the lost coin, and the prodigal son. Someone wants to know, well, in the first parable, what is the meaning of having 10 sheep? What's 10 mean? It means nothing. It's just a detail the Lord put in the story to sort of fill out to flesh out the story. It doesn't have a symbolic meaning. All right? Or a woman who hid the three measures of meal, took three measures of meal. Well, what's three mean? It means nothing. It's just what Jesus said. Right? But in an allegory, every detail has a meaning. Every element is symbolic. That's how allegories differ from parables in that respect. But on the surface, generally speaking, they are the same. It's a symbolic story that's got a deeper meaning that's being used to make a grander point here. So, Paul didn't tell a parable, he told an allegory. And every facet of this allegory has a meaning. In fact, the New American Standard says in verse 24, after he mentions the particulars to verse 23, my version says, "This then is allegorically speaking." And I think the King James says, "symbolically." Here's what I'm saying, Paul says. So after he gives us sort of the main characters, Hagar, who birthed Ishmael, and Sarah, who birthed Isaac. Now here's where Paul's going to go with all this. Here's the use of the story. Now let's start in verse 24, and let's read through the first part of verse 29. Verse 24, Paul says, "This is allegorically speaking, for these women are two covenants, one preceding from Mount Sinai, bearing children, who are to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery or bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, she is our mother. For it is written, 'Rejoice, barren woman who does not bear. Break forth and shout, you who are not in labor. For more are the children of the desolate than of the one who has a husband. And you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. But as at that time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit.'" And we'll stop right there for the allegory. That's really the allegory. Now, what's the point that Paul, or points that Paul makes? Well, he says the two women, they stand for the two covenants. Well, what two covenants? All right, the old law, first covenant, and the new law, second covenant. And is that germane to the problem in Galatia? Well, that's entirely on point. Because the Judaizers are saying to the Galatian Christians, you've got to come back to the first covenant. And Paul taught them, oh, you obey the gospel in Christ, you're the Lord's people. You're the children of promise. So here's where Paul's going to lay this thing out. He says, Hagar, she's fleshly. She represents the physical Jerusalem. Now again, why would saying physical Jerusalem, how would that fit the allegory? Yeah, when you compare the law and the gospel, which one is physical? More physical? Well, the law is. Sacrifices. And the gospel uses much more spiritual or figurative types, if you will, or examples. And the law was fleshly and physical. So all this is directly hitting, if I can use that word, the one covenant, the old one, with the other covenant, which is the new one. So now Hagar, she's fleshly, she's physical. And she represents those that are in bondage. Now that's right on point too. Because what's he already been saying in the letter to these Galatian Christians? If you go back to the law, you're going back to slavery. You're going back to bondage. Remember, he'd already said back in chapter 3 and verse 10, "Cursed is everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law to do them." And if you go back to a law system, you're under a curse. You're in bondage. You're sold unto sin. Because the first covenant had no way inherent in it to redeem anybody or to justify anybody. That wasn't the law's purpose. Just to continue our thinking along those lines, in chapter 3, what was the law's purpose? It was added because of sin, but it was to bring us to Christ. It was our tutor, our schoolmaster. So he'd already been through all those points. And we can kind of go back and pick some of those up to sort of help in our minds see where Paul's going with all this. So he says, the first woman, Hagar, well, she's fleshly, represented physical Jerusalem, and the bondage that results from being under that kind of a system. But he says, Sarah, this is verse 26, but the Jerusalem above, she is free. Sarah was spiritual, free, and represents the Jerusalem above. Well, what's the Jerusalem above? What, okay, what's the spiritual Jerusalem? All right, let's turn to Hebrews chapter 12. I thought of Hebrews 12. Parallel passage, I believe, on this idea. Hebrews 12. I don't want to spend too much time on this because I think eventually we could get confused on this. I'm not, and if you create confusion in the class, then you're really a bad teacher. We don't want to go down that road too much. But someone asked me one time, would it be fair to say that the New Testament church is our mother? I thought about that. And I thought, I don't really ever know of a passage that describes the church as our mother. Christ is, or God is our Father, and Christ is our Redeemer, and our brother in some passages. He's our fellow heir. But would the church ever be considered a mother? Well, I said no at the time, but I do think there is a passage in a figurative way that does describe the church as our mother. And this is Galatians chapter 4, the allegory that Paul... Now, I say that in an allegory, not literally, but in a figure of speech, in an allegory. Hebrews 12, let's start in verse 18 to get the context. Scott, if you read for us, please, Hebrews 12, 18 through... 18 through 24. Let's just consider the whole context, then we'll come back and talk about it. All right, in some respects, the Hebrew letter addresses the same problem as the Galatian letter. Here were Jewish Christians who were toying with going back to the law, and the Hebrew writer has extensively, in chapters previous to 12, that Scott just read from, has gone through great and detailed argumentation to show them the error of that thinking. You cannot go back to the law for all these reasons that he's already talked about. So he says in verse 18, now you've not come to the physical, Mount Sinai, the mountain that quaked and burned with the flashes of thunder and lightning when Moses brought them to that mountain to have them meet God, and God spoke to them the Ten Commandments, and so much so that he says in verse 20 that even if a beast touched the mountain accidentally, what was to happen? You've got to kill that animal, the cow or the whatever it was. You shoot that animal through. Because when God was on the mountain, it was holy, and nobody could touch it. He said, you've not come to such an arrangement. Verse 22, you've come to what mount? Not Sinai, Mount Zion. And whenever you read of Mount Zion in the Scripture, especially in the Old Testament prophecies, what are we talking about? Physical Jerusalem? No, the New Jerusalem. The New Covenant. The Lord's Second Covenant. The New Testament Kingdom of Jesus Christ. That's what he's talking about. So he describes it in those terms. The City of the Living God. The Heavenly Jerusalem. Verse 23. To the General Assembly and Church of the Firstborn, the New Testament arrangement. So we see some similar language here. So having reviewed that from Hebrews 12, back in Galatians 4, when he says the Jerusalem above compared to the Jerusalem on earth, the Jerusalem on earth was Hagar, a reference to the law, the covenant of Moses. This Jerusalem is above, talking about the New Testament arrangement, the New Testament kingdom. And that fits Paul's preaching. When he went through Galatia, he was converting them to Christ, having them obey the second covenant, not the first covenant. And so that's this allegory. So Hagar stands for the old way, Sarah stands for the new way, the second covenant, if you will. And he says, she stood for the ability to be free in Christ from the curse of the law. Again, what was the curse of the law? How much of it?
All of it.
That was the curse, to keep every commandment of the law under which no man can live, under which no man can operate successfully over a long period of time. So you see how Paul has pitted these two Old Testament characters against one another. Now, he says in verse 27, he says, "For it is written." Where does he quote? Well, it's Isaiah 54 and verse 1. Well, what's the previous chapter in Isaiah? Do some quick math. Isaiah 53. Well, does that ring a bell in our minds? Isaiah 53. Very messianic prophecy. The suffering Savior, the suffering Christ. Oftentimes read at the table when we break bread together. And so you continue that line of thinking into Isaiah 54. This was talking about a messianic time. Now, when you read this, verse 27, "Rejoice, barren woman who does not bear. Break forth and shout, you who are not in labor." Who does that sound like Paul's talking about? On the surface, it sounds like he's talking about Sarah. Because she was barren, wasn't she? She could not bring forth children. But that's not discussing Sarah. That doesn't fit the context. It's talking about, Isaiah was talking about Israel's hope in a barren captivity. When they would come back out under the Messiah, they would be that remnant and enjoy those blessings that are found in the new covenant. That's what Paul's going back and talking about. And again, it's important to understand that because the Judaizers and their teaching with trying to force the Galatian Christians into their line of thinking would have been to deny all those messianic prophecies that the prophets of old had always said God always intended to bless every man in who? In Christ. That was always God's plan. So he reaches back and he says, now, here's the whole system. What they're teaching you is Hagar. What I've taught you is Sarah. They taught you the physical. I taught you the spiritual. They taught you the bondage. I taught you the free. And he uses the wives of Abraham to symbolically illustrate his point here. If you don't listen to them, then you're of Hagar. You're a slave. If you listen to me and the gospel that I'm preaching, you'll be free. You'll be of Sarah. And you'll be what God always intended for you to be from the dawn of the creation, if you will. So, he says now, verse 28, "And you, brethren, like who? Like Isaac, are children of promise." Now, was Ishmael promised to Hagar? No. She was never promised that child, was she? Not at all. But through the laws of procreation, did she give birth to him? Well, obviously she did. Whose idea was it for Ishmael to be born anyway? Sarah's idea. Remember that? Back in Genesis 16, she got tired of waiting. They lived in Canaan already 10 years from the promise of chapter 12. And when God had said, "I'll make of thee a great nation," and nothing ever happened. So she finally just said to her husband, "Well, maybe I'll hear, just take my handmaid Hagar, perhaps I'll have children through her." And Abraham listened to his wife, he took Hagar, his wife, and he went into her, and she conceived and bore Ishmael. No, it was not uncommon. But was that God's plan? The answer is emphatically no. That was never the divine plan. It just happened because of human origin. So as Isaac was promised to Sarah, and again, we won't go back and read those verses, but in chapter 3, how much had Paul already discussed about being children of promise? If you be Abraham's seed, then are you heirs according to the promise. So he's already discussed at length being children of promise, just like Isaac was the child of promise, not Ishmael. Now, Sarah's birth, and I don't want to get too picky about this either. Someone says, "Well, I believe Isaac's birth was miraculous." Well, I hesitate to say that because whenever you use the word miracle, I like to use it the way the Bible uses it. Was there anything miraculous about Isaac's birth? Sarah was well beyond childbearing years, wasn't she? She was. But if you want to use the term miracle birth, I think it begins and stops with Jesus. Because why was his birth different than Isaac's birth? Born of a virgin. Had Sarah known a man? Yeah, she knew her husband, Abraham. Had Mary ever known a man? No. In fact, she says so much in that passage. She says, how can this be so? I've never even known a man. And that means in the sexual sense. I've never gone to bed with a man. How can I give birth to a child? So, rather than say miraculous, I just would rather say God did intervene in the situation and cause a woman and a man who were well beyond childbearing years to give birth to this child because He promised Abraham, you're going to have a son and you shall name him, even told him, you name him Isaac. That's back in Genesis. All right, our time is up for this morning. We'll complete this. We have just a very few comments to make to complete this part of the lesson. So come prepared. There's no class because of our singing Wednesday night. Come prepared next Sunday morning to start lesson 5, which is chapters 5 and 6 of Galatians. Thank you for your good comments this morning.